Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Santosh Hari. Santosh is a Microsoft MVP and public speaker. He is an Azure consultant where he leverages his broad Azure skill set to add more value to companies looking to migrate to the cloud. Welcome, Santosh.
Thank you.
Santosh, before we get started, would you just give us a little bit of an introduction to who you are and maybe tell us a little bit about how you got started in the industry?
Sure. So I am a Azure consultant at a company called New Signature, which is located in Orlando and in different parts of the US, Canada, and UK and other places. So I'm also a Microsoft MVP in Azure, been one since 2016. I run the Orlando.NET user group and also am co-organizer for the Orlando Code Camp. So other than that, I am proud owner of three dogs who keep me pretty busy. So yeah. How I got started. I was born in India. So that's where I got started, and that I got a ZX Spectrum as my first computer. And I picked up a bunch of books from an old bookstore and typed in basic programs, see if they would run. Also loaded plenty of games with a tape recorder. So, I'm real old school that way. So that's kind of my start into computers. I actually did not get serious about programming until I graduated my undergrad, which was in India too. And I was picked up from campus by one of the big shops. And they stuck me on a training to become a computer programmer. So that was pretty cool. I was paid and I was trained, so that's not something that I can complain about. But then they stuck me on a Y2K project. So the way I look at it is all the code I wrote for Y2K is why the world is safe today. So that's how I choose to look at it. So after working for a year on this Y2K project, I decided this was really not a scalable model. Because Y2K is going to be done in a year or so. So I needed to look out for my career. So I decided to get serious about computers and programming, and I decided to get a computer degree. So that's how I ended up in the United States. So I graduated from my college in the US around the time of the dot-com bust, not boom, bust. Mm. So had a hard time finding jobs. But fortunately, I ended up at a Microsoft conference that happened to be the launch of .NET 1. So somehow I picked up a DVD from there, installed it on my laptop, practiced a few programs. A week later, I applied for a job that was actually looking for .NET programmers and happened to get that job. So I ended up starting my career working for a Microsoft Gold partner. So I got pretty fortunate there. And this will also be why I always tell people to show up for tech events and networking and just put yourself out there. Don't wait for the opportunity. Put yourself out there and try to grab the opportunity.
So with your current job, what do you do these days? What are you working on?
My focus is enabling software teams to leverage the cloud, to make the most of the cloud, Azure cloud. So we do this by using DevOps principles. So I'm kind of at the confluence of Azure and DevOps, heavily invested in both. that is kind of what I do. In terms of like projects, it could depend. You know, some are lift and shift projects, some are ones where, you know, you build cloud native applications. So it just depends on the customer and what their needs are.
It's interesting that you had the experience in the dot-com bust that you did, because I also started my career during the dot-com bust. But my experience was a little bit different in that I found that I was cheap and willing to do those jobs that were no longer being done by the high-paid developers that had inevitably been laid off. So I was able to come in on existing projects and make a difference pretty early on and get up to speed pretty easily and follow really interesting architectures and code bases, all because I was willing to work much more cheaply than a lot of the unemployed developers in my city.
So my experience was that it was not because I was cheap or expensive, but it was the fact that no one was willing to sponsor a work visa back then. So every company I interviewed with, it was either rejected outright, or at some point they would say that, oh, you know, we're really not looking to sponsor because that's too expensive. So, you know, that's where the door shut on opportunities. So it was a tough time.
And you also do a lot of speaking about Cosmos DB, and that's why we brought you on today to talk a little bit about Cosmos DB, maybe what that is, when you want to look into using Cosmos DB, why, how, and so forth.
Yeah. Interesting story about Cosmos DB. I was doing a project where the traditional relational database is kind of failing me because of various issues like speed of incoming data and lack of schema conformity and stuff. So I started doing some research, and this was back in 2015-ish time period. I was doing some research, and I was already on Azure. So I was like, oh, let's see what options are there on Azure for storing somewhat loose schema data that's being ingested at a fast rate. And it turned out that Azure had a home-built solution called DocumentDB. That's how I got started on this journey. It was a NoSQL solution, but I like to not call them NoSQL. That's a strong preference of mine. It's a horizontally partitioned, scalable database solution, or schema agnostic solution. That's what I was looking for. And you know, anytime someone says NoSQL, it throws up flags, like, you know, this was probably a marketing term, or you know, because, you know, the first thing I discovered with Cosmos DB is that you can write SQL against Cosmos DB, so that's not NoSQL.
Yeah, I heard someone refer to NoSQL recently as not only SQL.
If you say no is an abbreviation, fair enough. So I got started on DocumentDB, and you know, I was kind of an early adopter and using DocumentDB in production. So you know, I went through the growing pains and learned quite a bit by putting things in production. That's how you learn.
Yeah,
testing in production. So so then I think this was back in 2017. They announced Cosmos DB. Cosmos DB is basically, they took the engine that used to run DocumentDB. They basically made this engine available not only for document-oriented databases, but you could also do graph databases and column databases like Cassandra. So that's how Cosmos DB, I ended up having like 2 years experience in Cosmos DB when Cosmos DB was launched. So, you know, that's like the dream for recruiters, I guess. I don't know. Cosmos DB, it's a multi-model, horizontally partitioned, schema-agnostic database solution. It supports APIs for SQL, which is basically a document-oriented database that supports SQL-style queries. It also supports APIs for Mongo. It has a table API, which is basically a key-value pair, and that is the same thing as the table storage in Azure. It's just a premium version of that. It has a API that supports graph databases, and that's called Gremlin. It uses the Gremlin engine to support that, and it has an API that supports column-oriented databases for Cassandra. I think recently they also launched an API that supports etcd. that supports Kubernetes. So that's I've not played around with that one that much, but it's supposed to be really cool in that, you know, you don't have much setup or maintenance of that, and everything is basically managed by Cosmos DB.
When might you decide to use something like Cosmos DB? What situations would be better for Cosmos DB versus something like Microsoft SQL?
You know, one of the things I look at is the basic tenets of big data, which is the three V's: volume, velocity, and variety. When you have data, that's, you know, you suddenly have to run queries against a large volume of data. That's certainly a great, you know, you can dump that data into Cosmos DB and run queries against that. One thing I would want is follow proper data modeling principles, and we'll talk about that maybe. You can certainly dump like terabytes of data into Cosmos DB, and as long as you have the proper data modeling principles, you can pretty much run queries against that and you'd get millisecond responses, which is pretty cool. The other thing is velocity. So if you have data being ingested at a fast rate, well, for instance, you know, let's say you have a system that has a bunch of IoT sensors or something, and they all come online at the same time, millions of them, and they send data. That's, you know, data coming in at a fast rate at the, you know, in a short period of time. So that would be a great use case for Cosmos DB. The other one is variety. So let's say you have similar data that's similar but different. So an example of this would be, let's say you have a bunch of devices from, you know, radio devices or devices that use radio spectrum. And all of these devices have some common fields. You know, they may have like a FCC ID and a serial number. But they also, you know, depending on the manufacturer, some of them may send other attributes, and, you know, some of them may be nested attributes or whatnot. So that's a huge variety of data. So, you know, instead of trying to deal with that with a relational database, we have to create a table for each device, basically. So I think Cosmos DB offers a solution where you can simply dump that data into Cosmos DB and you can query based on the common fields. So one thing about Cosmos DB is that it auto-indexes data. So if you have similar but different data, like the instance I just mentioned, and let's say all these tables have a field called serial number, it indexes data by name of the attribute. If you run a query against a serial number, it'll go and query only the records that have the field serial number. So that way, it restricts the lookup that it performs on data. So no record that does not have the serial number field will be returned in the query. So, or will even be considered for the query lookup. That's a great way of eliminating the amount of data and how it looks up data. So just look at your data and make your decision based on proper technical criteria, like whether it fits the volume, velocity, variety, not on superstition, like, you know, oh, Cosmos DB is cool, let's use that. Let's not. I've heard plenty of people, teams, you know, use that as a criteria, but that would not be a criteria, although I do think it's pretty cool. I just think that you just use it for the right reasons.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. A number of years ago, I was working on a rather large project with a lot of developers that have a lot of experience in relational databases. And the project ended up utilizing a document DB for all of the storage, but all of the documents that were being stored were very much relational in shape. So is that just, like you say, just the choice of picking something cool versus picking the right tool for the job? Would another feature in Cosmos DB be better suited for that? Maybe instead of document DB, maybe graph or column? How would you decide which of those features, which of those document stores to use?
Good question. So We did mention earlier that Cosmos has different models. Like you have SQL, which is basically document-oriented. SQL and Mongo are both document-oriented databases. And table is kind of a key-value pair. Graph is, you know, Gremlin, which is a graph-oriented database, and Cassandra, which is a column-oriented database. So each of these has its own use cases. document databases are ones, you know, it's basically the data looks like JSON if you look at the visual representation of the output. So it's JSON documents is what it is. The way I look at this data is it's denormalized data. So when you store data for any kind of not only SQL databases, you want to make sure that they don't have any features for connecting data with keys. So the solution to this is you go through a denormalization process. There's entire books written on how to model databases for these type of data stores. Just to give you a short description, you know, if you basically denormalize your data, and depending on whether your main field has one to few records or one to many records, you can either reference the data or you can embed the data within the same document. So if you ever do denormalization procedures, that's one way to do it. So that's for SQL or, you know, JSON document oriented data. Now for the table storage like we use in Azure, you know, we basically use that as log storage. You know, so if you have log type data, you can simply dump that in table storage. That's a great. You can also use table storage as key value pair. Graph, which is one of my favorite types of data stores, it's super relational. There's a talk on Cosmos DB. I think they did this at the launch of Cosmos DB, where they basically took every single character in the Marvel universe and dumped it into a graph database to see who is connected to who. It's really good for the use case for this is, you know, things like social media. Like if you go onto LinkedIn and say, oh, this is a second level connection or a third level connection, it's probably a graph database in the background that's doing that. So, you know, as your second and third level connect to you, someone else becomes a second or third level. So the graph databases do these kind of operations. And finally, Cassandra, that's a column database. And the use case for this is, I guess, if you want to do summary type data. So if I have a large number of, like, let's say temperatures that I got from a sensor. So what I want to do is I either want to run average, mean type operations on these temperatures. I could, you know, use a regular database, but when you have millions and billions of records and these are in distributed databases, the data gets split over multiple machines. So you don't want to run average type operations against distributed databases that store these records as rows. So what we do in column-oriented databases is that they take the columns and they bunch them together in the physical locations. So when you run these calculations, it actually goes and it's able to crunch these numbers faster because the columns are stored together. Because of physical proximity, it's able to run those calculations super fast. That is, and Cassandra is an example of that, a type of database that'll do that. Now, etcd, that's a completely different one. It's a key value pair that basically enables Kubernetes. So it's a support database for Kubernetes. So again, you know, just look at the use case, use it based on that, and not because it's cool.
One thing you mentioned earlier was some change feed as a neat feature of Cosmos DB. Now, I'll be honest, I have no idea what that is. So would you share with me and maybe our listeners who also aren't familiar?
Absolutely, yeah. So change feed is one of the most underappreciated features of Cosmos DB. What change feed is that if you're familiar with things like RSS feeds, so, you know, whenever someone publishes a blog post, it immediately shows up on an RSS feed. So change feed is basically something similar, but for data that comes into Cosmos DB. So every time you do an insert or update operation, it is published to something called a change feed. Now, the advantage of publishing it to a change feed is we are working in distributed environments. So when you're working in Azure, you know, obviously you're working in distributed environments. And with change feed, you can get multiple processes to look at the changes in data. So for instance, let's say I have fast incoming data into my Cosmos DB. I can hook up an Azure function to the change feed, but I can also hook up an events hub to the change feed. and I can hook up like a logic apps to the change feed and a bunch of different, and I can write my own custom code that looks at the change feed. So the change feed, now when you set up the change feed, what it does is it automatically creates a lease database. All the consumers that are looking at the change feed, they use the lease database to figure out what last record they looked at and what's next on the list. Again, we're working in a distributed environment. You never know when something is going to crash or cycle out or something. And using these type of lease databases, it's able to checkpoint itself. So if the consumer crashes, when it comes back, all it needs to do is pick up from the checkpoint and proceed. So it's a really stable way of doing event-driven architecture in the cloud. So change feed, it's one of the best features and most underutilized features of Cosmos DB. In fact, you know, when you hear things like Lambda architecture and event-driven architectures, that's enabled completely by change feed. So if you look up Lambda architecture with Cosmos DB, you can see how when you do Lambda architectures with other databases versus Cosmos DB, the change feed actually cuts down on the number of components you need to do the serving layer versus the speed layer. So that's, again, change feed enables a whole bunch of different options for consumers in the cloud, and it's also very stable. So it's like a production quality RSS feed for your data in the cloud.
That's fantastic. And then you kind of recently mentioned just there in the change feed discussion, connecting to the change feed with functions or other things. What are some of the ways to connect to Cosmos, the data itself? Are there limitations there or what's available?
Sure. So the way you connect to Cosmos is, you spin up a Cosmos instance in Azure, and then it gives you an endpoint and a key. So again, if you're doing it, the way I would do it is I would use ARM templates to create this. When the ARM template creates the resource, I'd simply take the key and push it into a key vault and then have my applications talk directly to the key vault. Now, what you're doing to connect to Cosmos DB, regardless of whether you use the .NET SDK or you use Python, Java, whatever it's your programming language is, or you can even do REST calls. So all of these are basically abstraction layers for the REST calls to the API. Again, you're doing simple API calls back and forth. That opens up a whole world of applications that you can connect to Cosmos DB. So all you need is the endpoint and the key. So you can write your own custom applications. You can write your applications in C#, JavaScript. You can even do Blazor applications, Clayton. Actually, there's a pretty cool example. I forget the name of the guy, but he does like Cosmos DB with Blazor. So, but because Cosmos DB is Azure-based, you can also hook up Azure services like Azure Functions. Azure Functions has bindings for Cosmos DB. So you can connect to the change feed, or you can read and write data directly from Cosmos DB collections using the bindings. So what the bindings do is they reduce the number of lines of code you write to open a client, close a client, and maintain the connection. So everything is managed by the bindings in Azure Functions. Now, you can also hook up logic apps to Cosmos DB. So that's a simple connector in the logic apps. Event hubs, you can point event hubs to the change feed. Cosmos DB can act as a source for Power BI. So you can put data into Cosmos DB and simply open up Power BI, point it to Cosmos DB, and run your reports against Cosmos. So I'm sure that Cosmos also connects to other services, but these are the most common cases. A few other things I should mention. If you're into doing Jupyter Notebooks, Cosmos DB has comes with a feature where you can enable Jupyter Notebooks and use it directly against your Cosmos account. So that's pretty awesome. And Cosmos DB also has connectors for Databricks. So if you need to run, if you need to spin up Databricks instance to do calculations against your data, It comes with inbuilt connector for Databricks. So it's very easy to connect Databricks to your Cosmos account and simply spin up machines, run analysis against your data. That it makes it pretty easy. So again, everything is enabled because it's a simple API calls in the backend. So
it's a brave new world. It seems like there's a way to store data however you want to store it, retrieve data any way you want to retrieve it using whichever language of your preference. So it's really a great time to be in tech.
Absolutely. And one of the other things I would talk about Cosmos DB is there's often the developer who spins up Cosmos DB, forgets to delete it, and you know they get charged $25-$50 against the account and for having like 100 records in their database or something. So again, the value of Cosmos DB, I would say, is something called a total cost of ownership or non-ownership. So basically, you are getting this database that's super fast, infinitely scalable, so you can replicate Cosmos DB instances across the world simply by clicking on a map, or you know you can do it programmatically or with DevOps pipelines. But also you can enable Cosmos DB to have multi-masters, which means that since my database is distributed all over the world, let's say I have clients in Australia and the US, I can have the Australian clients write to the Cosmos DB instance region that's nearest to them. And I can have the US clients write to the Cosmos DB region that's closest to them, and it automatically syncs the data. So all of that is handled completely by Microsoft. The backups, the recovery, the security, everything is handled by Microsoft. So, you know, you don't have to have infrastructure teams that handle this type of headaches. I would say, you know, one of the major reasons you should look into that is because of the total cost of ownership, not having to maintain all of this, and simply getting your teams to focus on solving business problems as opposed to doing maintenance of the infrastructure.
Yeah, and we're nearing the end of the year here as we record. I think by the time this is published, it'll be early 2020. So we're starting to wind down, but I know that you're probably starting to wind up planning for next year's Orlando Code Camp.
Oh, yeah. So thanks for bringing that up. So Orlando Code Camp is on March 28th, and it's at Seminole State College in Sanford, Florida. And it's a whole day of events and free for all attendees. We already have about 50 speakers submit for it, so we are expecting to have a full slate of speakers and fantastic speakers from all over the world. You know, please come join us for Orlando Code Camp and sign up on orlandocodecamp.com.
So for folks who might be looking to get started in Cosmos, is there any resources that you might point them in the right direction?
So this Microsoft Docs, I would say, you know, get started with Microsoft Docs and learn the basics. So Cosmos has different models. If you're starting on Cosmos, start with learning about the SQL API and SQL queries. Read up from Microsoft.docs. There's also cosmosdb.github.io. That's a website that has some sample code. There's a Pluralsight course on Cosmos DB by Lenny Lobel. So I would definitely do that Pluralsight course. Again, there's blogs. There's plenty of blogs in other places, but you know, these are the three major places I would get started at.
One of the things we ask everyone when we come on, bring them on, if they have any advice or would speak any words of wisdom to our listeners who are just getting started, what would you say to them?
My advice, regardless of whether you're getting started or you have 20, 30 years experience in the field, is if you're already not, get involved in your tech community, whether it's online or local, preferably both. I've reaped great rewards, including my first job and my current job, from being involved in tech communities and the people I met there and the things I learned there. So that would be my number one advice. And my second and advice, again, this is probably more geared towards people. Actually, let's just make it for everyone. Is at some point, as you progress through your career, you'll feel some kind of burnout. And this is going to happen. So take care of yourself. You know, work is always there. So make sure you're taking care of yourself physically and mentally and doing things to not burn out.
Yeah, great advice. If people want to follow you or sort of find what you're doing or contact you, what would be the best ways for them to do that?
It's a funny story. I had a guest over for Thanksgiving, and my nephew was sleeping in my office. And he looked around, and he saw this box that had my MVP award on it. So when he Googled my name, it came up with all sorts of information about me. So apparently, if you Google me, you can find me. So the other place is Twitter. My handle is not very user-friendly, _S_Hari, because apparently, like everyone else with the same name as me, have taken up all the different combinations, and these jerks don't even tweet, so that's kind of annoying. Definitely LinkedIn. If you look me up on LinkedIn, hopefully I'm the first result. Maybe not. Hopefully I'm the first result. Yeah.
How about upcoming speaking engagements? We mentioned Orlando Code Camp, but are you going to be at any other conferences or user groups or something?
So you said this is getting published the first week of January. So I will probably be in CodeMesh, Ohio, in the first week of January. So if you're in CodeMesh, Ohio, come say hi to me. I won't bite, I promise. And I'm also hoping to speak at South Florida Code Camp, which is at the end of Feb. Again, if I would highly recommend attending that event. It's by our friends in South Florida. And Orlando Code Camp, which is at the end of March. I will also be at the MVP Summit in the middle of March. Beyond that, I don't have any conference acceptances currently. So if you're listening to this podcast and you run a conference, please accept me.
All right. Thanks, Santosh. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you.
That was Santosh Hari. Santosh is a Microsoft MVP and public speaker. He's an Azure consultant at New Signature, where he leverages his broad Azure skill set to add more value to companies looking to migrate to the cloud.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Nash.